That brings us into our regular Saturday Night Culture panel. A warm welcome to Times Radio. And thanks for being with us, by the way, if you've joined us this evening. You can sit back and relax with, I don't know, a glass of something fizzy or a warm cup of something as we welcome in our panellists this evening. So for the next 45 minutes, we're joined by Hayley McGee. Hello to you, Hayley.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure. And Phil Eropoulos. Evening, Phil.
Hello, how are you doing? Thank you very much for having me too.
Absolute pleasure. We're going to talk through the latest culture news. We'll also find out what you two are up to or getting up to. And we'll also find out as well from both of you what your recommendations are, what to watch, read, listen to or go and see. It's always an interesting way to get into the heads of our guests. Hayley, let's start with you first of all in terms of finding out a little bit more about you. You describe yourself as a Canadian multidisciplinary artist. The big news for you, your Edinburgh show, Age is a Feeling, has just won, well, rave five-star reviews. I was reading some of them earlier. And you've earned one of the Scotsman's Fringe First Awards as well, which I'm sure you're absolutely delighted with. The solo show chronicles turning 25 and explores the decades ahead. I don't have a clip of it because I know you're going to be taking it to the Soho Theatre, aren't you, very soon? But
that's
so right. We can get a bit of you in action. Shall we hear one of your previous shows, The Ex-Boyfriend Yard Sale, inspired by a quest to find an algorithm to measure sentimental value.
1+, the key highs divided by the key lows in the relationship, plus how much joy there was in the relationship divided by how much misery there was, plus how much you laughed over how often you fought, plus the quality of the biggest romantic gesture they ever performed for you, multiplied by how reliable they were on a day-to-day basis, plus how much you liked their people divided by how much your people liked them.
There we go. That was from The Ex-Boyfriend Yard Sale, which was all about you having a big credit card debt and the bank telling you to sell some stuff to try and pay it back. And so you look around your flat and the only things worth selling are gifts from ex-boyfriends, which is a brilliant premise for the play. I do want to know more about Age is a Feeling. So this is the show that's just been at Edinburgh. You're due to take it to the Soho Theatre. Tell me a bit about researching the show and sort of how it came about.
Sure. Well, Age is a Feeling, as you said, it's a story that starts on your 25th birthday and takes you all the way through your life to your death. And the very, very, very beginnings of the show started when a theater called Camden People's Theater asked me if I would write a 15-minute piece for their 25th anniversary. And I'd had this title in my head, Age is a Feeling. I knew I wanted to write something about aging. I was coming into my mid-30s, and it was front of mind. And so I thought I would write a kind of letter to a 25-year-old about how the body deteriorates and the way that when you turn 25, your brain actually finishes developing. So your child brain doesn't actually finish developing until you turn 25 around that time.
Doesn't it? And so, really? Like, seriously?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Seriously, I learned this. And so it means that until you're 25, you can't actually comprehend long-term planning, risk assessment. It's why people are so reckless in their teenage years. They haven't fully grasped their own mortality. And so I thought, well, what an interesting thing to write a letter to a 25-year-old about how to live without fearing death now that they're newly aware of the fact that one day they will die. And so I dove into a kind of research process where I started simply by posting on my social media things like, where did you first feel age in your body? What advice would you give yourself at 25? What advice would you give yourself at 50? What regrets do you have looking back on your life? And through those responses, I started building this letter to a 25-year-old. And so from there, the piece snowballed and I ended up doing quite a lot more research. I talked to medical doctors who specialize in geriatrics and aging.
Yeah.
I talked to some mystics. I talked to someone who does past life regression. I was sort of dabbling questions about the afterlife. And I talked to people about egg freezing. I talked to someone who trains people who work in hospice. Really, I was starting to get very curious about different relationships with mortality or things that we do to try to push back death. And so all those things came together in this show. And in the show, there are 12 stories that the audience could hear. But because of the unknowable nature of a human life, in each show, the audience chooses which six they'll hear. So they get a picture of this life, but they don't get the full picture.
That's a really good concept for a show as well. And I already tell, I mean, it sounds so intensely researched and you pull it off as well. The Guardian's review said that if it had been written by a performer at the end of her life, it would count as an astonishing insight into the human condition. For McGee to show such wisdom at 36 is as breathtaking as it is moving. So a huge congratulations on it. As we said, it's on the way to the Soho Theatre and it'll run from the 6th of September. So next week up to the 7th of March next year. You've got kind of various performances at various times on various days. But if you sound, if that sounds interesting or you've seen some of the reviews for Hayley's show, Age is a Feeling, you can head along to the Soho Theatre to check it out for real. Brilliant stuff. Let's meet our other panellists this evening. I'm joined by Phil Iropoulos, who's a Greek artist and filmmaker. Phil is one half of FYTA. It's a conceptual audio textual performance duo. And FYTA are taking their critically acclaimed queer opera Orpheus 2021 to the Whitechapel Gallery this September as part of Fringe Queer Film Fest. It's a modern take on Monteverdi's opera L'Orfeo, dedicated to the memory of their friend, the drag performer and artist Zach Kostopoulos. If I've got that correct, I'm so sorry if I've pronounced that wrong.
No, it's all good. It's correct, yes, sure.
Should we listen to a little bit of it and then we can talk some more? Phil, it sounds wonderful. Tell me more about the show and about your role in it.
We were invited by the Greek National Opera to produce a queer theatre piece. They didn't exactly know what they wanted with that. They had an idea that opera is something that should have queer works, and there wasn't any queer works in the Greek body of work. So they invited us to do something, and they weren't 100% sure what they wanted exactly from us. I think they wanted something which was... flashy and glittery and colorful. And so we started working on this, on a recreation of Orfeo. The reason we worked with this piece is because it's considered by some people the first opera. And as such, the style of the whole genre of opera was not really fixed by the point that Monteverdi composed it, because it was such an early style. So in a way, it's a very old postmodern piece, if I'm allowed to make this kind of strange time travel assumption in a way. So we took this work and we thought, okay, perhaps there's something to this notion of collage that happened in early opera that we can bring to talk about queer identity and queer politics and queer bodies in 2020. While we were making the work and while we were writing it, something happened that drastically changed its course. So originally it was going to be something which was not necessarily lighthearted, but it was going to be bright and say hopeful and so on. And then our friend, an activist and drag queen and colleague, Zach Kostopoulos, was murdered in the middle of Athens in broad daylight, actually, by civilians and the police, which really shocked the whole of the queer community. And it's still very much an open wound. And so at that point, we were like, okay, then we have to bring this into the work. Mm. So the work became about this. Tragically, the work already featured a murder. So the work, not a murder, but a sort of death by the gods, which seemed like a purposeful death, let's say, in the original work. Mm. So we were a bit like, oh, okay, the myth kind of took its revenge on us in a way, and made it this this kind of thing actually happen. And we were like, huh, okay, now it's us, and we are seeing this. We're witnessing this moment where, as artists, we've been told by the Greek National Opera to make queer work, and that surely is a kind of development for Greek, cultural politics, let's say. But at the same time, our friend was killed in the streets, so we lived through this kind of contradiction. So the work is influenced a lot by the work that this person has been doing as an activist over the years, and also dedicated to him/her. Now, I don't know do you want me to talk about a little bit about how the whole thing works in terms of the connection with the opera and the new material?
Possibly. We are a little bit short on time, actually, Phil. So if you can sum it up fairly briefly, yes, by all means. Or we can see if we can get a little bit of time to talk about that later on.
I mean, the main thing that we do in this work is that we are... we're trying to bring elements. You wouldn't necessarily have gotten that from the excerpt that we heard, because it was a clear Baroque one. But throughout the piece, there are a lot of different styles that change. So it's an attempt to fuse Baroque and postmodern aesthetics.
Yeah, listen, it sounds really exciting. So that's heading to the Whitechapel Gallery this September as part of Fringe Queer Film Fest. Let's take a quick pause. When we come back, we're going to work through some of this week's art and culture news to get your opinion on those stories. We'll be back in just a moment's time.
Times Radio Breakfast with Chloe Tilley and Callum MacDonald.
We'll be looking ahead to the outcome of the Conservative Party leadership contest. What are the big issues that the Prime Minister will have to deal with as soon as they take charge?
After President Biden said Donald Trump's supporters are a threat to democracy, we'll reflect on Donald Trump's Save America rally taking place in Pennsylvania.
And two people called Harry and Meghan arrive in the UK next week.
Who are they?
Yeah, good question. We'll find out who they are and what they'll be up to.
Times Radio Breakfast with Chloe Tilley and Callum MacDonald. Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio. Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
Good evening to you. This is Kate Borsay with you here through until 1 a.m. We're in the middle of our culture panel, and our guests this evening, Phil Aropoulos, who is a Greek artist and filmmaker, and Hayley McGee, who's a Fringe First award-winning performer. Let's run through some of this week's culture stories. We'll see how many that we can fit in. Let's go to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, pertinent for you both, I'm sure. It's faced calls to introduce new guidelines for future shows. This is after Asian audience members said that they were subjected to publicly licensed racism during a show that was on there this festival. The British East and Southeast Asians working in theatre and screen industry complained about a play in which a white male actor portrays a geisha, a traditional Japanese hostess. The show's producer has since hit back at the accusations of racism, as did the actor performing. Here's a bit from the show's trailer.
Helicopters circling over temples of consummation and guards making sure we're safe. A mother screams, a child cries 250 meters under the earth. I hear insatiable greed of an insatiable machine.
So the play sees the traditional geisha openly question her role as an entertainer, and it also contains themes of abuse, child labour, trafficking and slavery, which are all explored in it. But the problem with the show has been that the artist involved decided to portray the character using yellow face, which has led to the complaint. And so the group involved here who made the complaint are saying that Edinburgh should release guidelines to try and stop this from happening again. It's tricky territory, this. Hayley, let's come to you first of all. Should Edinburgh release guidelines on what is and isn't appropriate content for shows? And if they should, then what should those guidelines be?
Gosh, it is such a tricky topic. It's also tricky, you know, even weighing in on this, because I'm not a person of color. I'm white. And so I feel a little, I feel a little bit like, am I really the right person to be talking about it? But I think the question you're asking around guidelines is a great way to sort of talk about this, in the abstract. I do think that we're learning more and more about how what we put on stage has an impact, yes, on people in the audience, but also in who thinks that they're allowed to be on stage. And mm-hmm. Edinburgh has a huge problem. We've been reading about it, about access and diversity. And so I think that in order to change that, there does need to be a raising of consciousness, or people need to start thinking more deeply about what kind of acts are going to be programmed there. Because if people don't see themselves on stage, or in fact, if people see stereotypes of themselves or stereotypes of people that they know, I think it can make them feel pretty unwelcome and make the festival seem like a hostile environment. And that is precisely what the festival needs to not be in order to correct a lot of the issues around the diversity of the performers.
Yeah. The show is called The Tea Ceremony, and it has been performed in other countries, including Germany. Phil, for you, the group, the British East and Southeast Asians Working in Theatre and Screen Industry, they're known as BEATS, who complained about the play, recognise that no one wants rules. That's in their statement. But they also say, you know, we've got no wish to see a sanitised and conservative fringe. The problem is, though, that with outdated racist performance tropes, a sanitised and conservative fringe is exactly what we get. So whereas some people might say free speech, you should absolutely be able to go and push the boundaries when it comes to the Fringe Festival. They are arguing actually that it then becomes a very polarised view because you're, you know, peddling certain racist tropes. This is all according to them. It is tricky territory. Should there be specific guidelines set out by the organisers of Edinburgh?
I mean, I don't think it's such a tricky territory, to be honest. I think the intricacies of cultural appropriation could have various areas that are tricky, but I think yellow face is not a tricky area. I think yellow face is a clear no-go, should be a clear no-go. There is a, you know, with yellow face and black face and so on, there is a very long history of how those practices have been connected to oppression. And so for me, this is not a question of you know, of the difficulties that a complex political work might have. This is just something that is from another time. I just don't think we should be doing this anymore. And I have another question as well. I'm wondering, why is it that still today, Western card shows, they need to resort to the East for inspiration? And it makes you wonder, is the West so poor in terms of ideas that it needs to resort to other cultures?
Well, I think people are fascinated. In fact, one of your picks later on, I think it's yours, Hayley, looks at geishas as well, and there is a fascination there about them. Would it have been okay if the actor portrayed the character but didn't use yellow face, didn't use makeup to make himself try and represent a geisha, Phil?
I mean, it's very difficult to think about what and if and so on. And of course, I for sure, as Hayley said, I'm not the person. I'm also white or Greek white. I don't know if that has any complexity. But I'm also not the person that would be the right person to decide this. And I do think, yes, that there are complexities to cultural appropriation that are very difficult. I would certainly imagine that that it would be much better. And I don't think that a work that deals with the thematic of geishas as such is something, or that includes this thematic, is something that is a no-go. I think there are particular practices and they have to do very, you know, they often have to do with body representation and the face So I don't think our freedom is really endangered if there are like really just a few things that we shouldn't be doing.
Okay. If you'd like to contribute to the discussion and you're listening, just a quick reminder, you can tweet us using the hashtag Times Radio or get in touch via text 87222. Start your message with the word Times. Now, who knew? BBC Radio 4's Front Row programme has found that publishers often pay booksellers to be in their stores and, in one case, on their best-selling lists. A publisher shared an email trail with at the Front Row show that detailed its negotiations with the high street chain WH Smith over a new book. And the programme spoke to Mark Stay, who works as a publisher, or who has worked as a publisher for more than 25 years.
So £2,000 for what you would call promotional space. So that included the book of the week and then a place in the fiction chart, as long as sales sort of warranted it. They wanted about 2,000 to 3,000 copies of the book to be in the store. Now, what do you make of that?
That sounds like a pretty good deal, actually. I think it's been more expensive than that in the past. I would imagine as well that on top of that, Smith's would be asking for extra discount off the book.
I had no idea that this occurs. Publishers or bookstores like Waterstones, by the way, their chief executive James Daunt said that his chain stopped doing that when he took over in 2011. They lost revenues amounting to £27 million in lost deals. That was the retailer WH Smith being discussed in that clip. We should point out that the Sunday Times bestseller list uses a service called Nielsen Bookscan, which is based solely on sales. But what do we make of this, Hayley? The fact that you can negotiate. So for your book, for example, your publisher could phone up WH Smith and negotiate a prominent position for it and an entry into their version of their bestsellers chart.
Yeah, well, it's just disheartening, isn't it? I mean, we all know at this point that the world is not a meritocracy, but to think that certain books are being being pushed to the top of a chart that you think is based on sales is quite disheartening. And, you know, I get the other argument that, okay, this is a form of marketing. This is a way that publishers can market books and you can buy a spot, a prominent spot in a bookstore. But to buy a spot on a bestseller's chart does seem particularly deceptive.
Supermarkets don't have bestseller lists, but some do charge publishers to be stocked in their stores and often request different amounts depending on where the books are positioned in shops. So it happens in supermarkets too. It's not just WH Smith. We should make sure that we make that clear.
Yeah.
For the programme, they spoke to Kat Mitchell, who's a lecturer in publishing at the University of Derby, Phil. And she said, actually, it's not as bad as you think because the system self-regulates, because a publisher and a store would never exchange money for a book that's a no-hoper. In other words, it has to be a decent book in the first place for this to make sense. They wouldn't just put anything there. Is that any kind of justification?
I mean, I don't know. I'm a little bit skeptical of the whole bestseller thing anyway. I mean, why does someone need to know if something is a bestseller in order for them to try this book? Because obviously anything that has to do with lots of sales would probably have gone at various stages all sorts of marketing tricks for it to reach that point. So whether in this very final point that the counting of the books is correct or not, to me seems somewhat irrelevant. I would, you know, if it was up to me, I would like a world where there is no such thing as judging a book by how many copies it sells. So I would scrap the whole bestseller book thing on shelves anyway. And it doesn't happen around the world. It's a British or American thing, really.
Yeah, it's sort of a fascination with charts and ranking, isn't it? And I think we are influenced by a book that's on a best-selling list. It is almost like a validation. But I mean, having been a published author yourself, Hayley, how much was that, you know, something to lust after from your point of view or from your publisher's point of view? How much was there a chase after, you know, being in a certain position on a bestseller's chart?
Well, it's interesting because my book, the Ex-Boyfriend Yard Sale, but I turned the show into a book. It was a bestseller at Canada's Waterstones, which is called Indigo.
Are you sure?
Yes. I mean,
sorry, that's actually really mean of me. But
I don't know. I'll have to call up and ask. Did it get there on its own merits? And that was really important to us because it's one of those. It's a kind of a popularity contest
thing.
When other people say that it's good, then other people are more willing to take a chance on it. And Phil, I so agree with you. I so wish that there weren't star ratings on pieces of art and this obsession with charts and gamifying and ranking. It's so depressing, and it takes away the kind of wonderful thing of going into a bookshop or going into a library and engaging in a conversation with someone and having them recommend something to you based on your tastes or your interests, or just fanning through things and not knowing, oh, this is the star and all of these are somehow slightly less.
Yeah.
I mean, of course they're not. Celebrity is such a big part of these bestseller lists that people who are already popular, of course, are going to sell more books, and then the bestseller lists just perpetuate that. Sorry, Phil.
Yeah.
Imagine if you had this, instead of having bestseller books, you had like individual curations by various people that this week you're going to, you know, we're going to have like 8 suggestions by this writer.
But we do also get that. But I suppose then that leads to the question, will, you know, Jimmy the sales assistant book of the week, is there a financial incentive for Jimmy to put his name to that particular book?
I didn't so much mean Jimmy as I meant like this week we've got Laurie Anderson picking 8 books and you know, and making actually an event. A way.
All right. Well, listen, we will round up there on some of those culture stories of the week. We only managed to get through 2. We will whiz through some of your picks after the news. We'll be finding out what you have been watching and listening to recently. That's all to come here on the Culture Panel with Phil Eropoulos, Greek artist and filmmaker, and Hayley McGee, who is a Fringe First award-winning performer. More from those 2 after the news with Chris Dabbs.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thanks, Kate. It's being predicted that Liz Truss will become Prime Minister and the new leader of the Conservative Party on Monday when the Tory leadership contest results are announced. And she said that she will take immediate action on energy bills during her first week in office if she becomes Prime Minister on Tuesday. Talking to us earlier, Chief Political Commentator for the Sunday Times, Tim Shipman, explained how she deals with the cost of living crisis will affect the next election.
But I think it's pretty clear that she's realised that the scale of this is such that it's something where you can't just muck about with tax changes. It sounds like they're looking at a massive cut in VAT, which would get into everybody's pockets immediately. It sounds like there's all sorts of plans for uplifting benefits, which will target, you know, those specific groups that are on benefits.
Senior officials at NASA say the leak that forced it to call off today's liftoff of the unmanned Artemis 1 to the moon is too complex to be fixed in a matter of days. They've missed this launch window, and their next chance will either be later this month or early October. Jackie Goddard is the US correspondent for The Times, and she told us earlier that NASA sees this mission as a testbed.
This is a test mission. These are 2 new vehicles, the world's biggest operational rocket, most powerful, and a brand new spacecraft that has never flown with this rocket. And this mission is to put them through their paces, not only the vehicles, but the ground systems that handle them. So everything from the fueling process to every last nut and bolt being secure.
An updated COVID booster vaccine, which targets two variants of the virus, has been approved for use in the UK. The second bivalent vaccine, which works against both the original strain and the Omicron variant, follows a similar booster from Moderna last month. From Monday, millions of people will begin to receive their autumn booster, with care home residents first in line. And in the weather, tonight the Northern Isles and the far north of the mainland will stay dry with long clear spells, and it'll be cloudy and windy tonight with some heavy rain in the north. We'll have overnight temperatures of 15 degrees in Edinburgh and 17 degrees in London. Tomorrow will be sunny in the southeast with clouds in eastern regions, and Wales will be dry later in the day. And with the sport, here's Kane Reeves.
England secured World Cup qualifications as goals from Alessia Russo and substitute Nikita Paris were enough for the European champions to beat Austria 2-0. The World Cup will be held next year in Australia and New Zealand. Aston Villa eased the pressure on manager Steven Gerrard with a hard-fought 1-1 draw against champions Manchester City at Villa Park. Villa levelled in the second half through Leon Bailly after Erling Haaland had given the visitors the lead with his 10th goal for the club. West Ham manager David Moyes was highly critical of the officials after his side were denied a late goal in their 2-1 defeat at Chelsea. Maxwell Cornet's 90th minute strike was ruled out after a VAR review for a foul in the build-up.
It's a scandalous decision. Absolutely rotten decision from one of our supposedly elite referees. So it doesn't say much about whoever sent him over on VAR as well. It's an unbelievable decision that went against us.
Tottenham have maintained their unbeaten start to the season with a 2-1 victory at home to Fulham. Goals from Pierre-Emile Højbjerg and Harry Kane earned them a win over their London rivals. Bournemouth fought back to claim a second Premier League win of the season with a 3-2 victory at Nottingham Forest, while Wolves have their first win of the campaign, beating Southampton 1-0. Ivan Toney scored a hat-trick as Brentford beat Leeds 5-2. The Merseyside derby finished goalless at Goodison Park, as did Newcastle against Crystal Palace. Celtic have the Old Firm bragging rights after a 4-0 win over Glasgow rivals Rangers to move 5 points clear at the top of the Scottish Premiership. Ange Postecoglou's side were 3-0 up at the break.
You know, we knew it would be a good challenge for us today. They're a good side, and they've proven they're a good side. But, you know, we've been really good all, you know, since the season started. We're getting stronger every week, and just thought it was a really, you know, dominant performance.
British tennis number one Cam Norrie is through to the fourth round of the US Open. He saw off 28th seed Holger Rune in an impressive straight sets victory in New York. Our colleagues on TalkSport have more reaction to today's Premier League results. You can hear it on air or visit their website.
Times Radio with Kate Borsay.
Good evening to you. Kate Borsay with you here on Times Radio. Through until 1am, we're in the middle of our culture panel. You've arrived just in time if you've just tuned in, to find out a little bit about our panel, what they've been listening to and reading and going off to see. It gives you an insight into them, but also allows you to pick up some recommendations along the way if you've run out of things to watch or run out of inspiration. This evening on the show, we're joined by Phil Eropoulos, who is an artist and filmmaker. His show, it's a queer opera called Orpheus, and it will be at the Whitechapel Gallery this September. And Hayley McGee also joins us as well. She's a Fringe First award-winning performer, and her show Age is a Feeling will be on at the Soho Theatre also from September. So welcome back to both of you. Now I've got your recommendations, things you've been enjoying recently on the arts and culture front. And Hayley, let's start with you and a show. It's on Now TV and it's called The Rehearsal. It's a bit of a social experiment kind of slash therapy innovation. Nathan Fielder, who is the chap who was behind a really good show on Comedy Central, which I've completely forgotten the name of, but he's
Nathan For You.
Thank you, Nathan For You. Behind that kind of cult show, he basically finds people who need to have difficult conversations and he recreates the conditions under which they're going to have that interaction, trying to anticipate possible outcomes as he prepares the real person for the conversation. So a rehearsal, as per the name of the show. Let's hear a bit from the trailer.
I've been told my personality can make people uncomfortable.
Hey, how to make love all night.
Well, you know.
I think we're going to get along pretty well.
But I've learned that if you plan for every variable, a happy outcome doesn't have to be left to chance.
This conversation's going pretty well.
Yes.
So that's no accident. everything that's happened today.
Oh, this sounds fascinating. And I've not actually heard of it until you brought it to my attention. I was having a watch of it today and a little read about what it's all about. why are you drawn to the show? And does it ever get too bizarre? Because you must be left wondering kind of what's real and what's not real. I don't know whether that's the case.
It does get deeply bizarre. It's, you know, he starts out with this premise that he's going to help prepare people for difficult situations. And he goes to extreme lengths to do this. So the first episode is a guy who needs to confess to his quiz team, his essentially pub quiz team, that he lied about having a master's degree. And so Nathan recreates the pub that they meet in every week down to the finest details. And he gets an actor to study the friend that he's most nervous to talk to. And then they rehearse over and over with all the different outcomes. And then in the second episode, there's a woman who wants to have she's not sure if she wants to have a child. So over a 2-month period, she rehearses raising a baby to an 18-year-old with the child getting older by 3 years every week. But partway through, her fantasy was to raise a child with a partner, and she can't find a guy to do it. So Nathan's like, you know what? How about I step in platonically? And he ends up getting totally embroiled in the experiment. And one of the little kids forms a very strong attachment to him, and it raises all these kind of ethical questions. Yeah. And so the show follows that alongside the other rehearsals.
It goes off in a completely different direction as well.
He allows it to have this kind of tangent, and it's so deep. It's deeply funny while also being incredibly interesting and unlike anything I've ever seen on TV. I devoured it in 2 days.
Yeah, okay. So that is called The Rehearsal, if it sounds like your cup of tea. And I love the fact that it sounds crazy and you don't quite know where it's going to go, as well as someone who can recreate scenes to rehearse in that much detail as well. It begs the question really about a production company or a network being kind of brave enough to back something like this. That's The Rehearsal, and it's on Now TV. That's Hayley's first pick. Phil, let's go to yours. This is Sun and Sea Marina, which is an opera performance by Lena Lapalette, is her name. It's an exploration of our relationship with the planet, the threat that climate change presents, and the dangers that we face if it's ignored. Let's listen to a bit of the trailer.
My voice ain't in a car. And he has been swimming in the black, the yellow, the white, the red, the Mediterranean, Aegean Sea.
How can we access this, first of all? And then just tell us why you've been devouring it recently. It's a few years old now, isn't it?
Unfortunately, it was at LIFT 2022, from the 23rd of June to the 10th of July. So if you haven't seen it, you've just missed it in terms of its London show anyway. So I'm not too sure 100% how someone can watch this now.
Maybe we can access it online or something. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I think it is. It was meant to travel around the UK, so I don't know if there are more shows at the moment. This premiered at the Lithuanian Pavilion at the Venice Biennale, where it won the top prize in 2019, and it's been touring since then. It's a very, very odd opera. its basis is climate change, but it wants to do that in a kind of non-didactic and quite poppy way, in a way. So the setup is that what the audience sees is just a lot of people that are just lying down on a beach and they're having fun and like drinking and so on. And gradually more and more people are talking about climate change, and you realize that there are all these people that kind of feel like they can't really do nothing other than chill at the beach, but at the same time there's this huge elegy about what do we do now. So it's a very and another thing which works really well is that as the characters are under the hot sun, they get more and more delirious. So as the piece progresses, it becomes more poetic and abstract. So it's a very interesting experimental opera, basically. But although experimental opera might scare some people off, it's actually quite a funny show at the same time.
All right, well, that is Sun and Sea, Marina. It may be popping up again on tour soon if you want to check it out. Hayley, let's go to your book. It's a bit of a classic, isn't it? Wild Swans by Yung Tang. Just give us the reason why you love this book. It's for those people who think, yes, I know it, but I'm not quite sure what it's about. It basically follows three generations of Chinese women through the 20th century, and the sort of granddaughter, the youngest woman, is the writer of the book. Tell us why you're so drawn to it.
Well, I have to tell you, I'm only a quarter of the way through
it. Oh, okay.
And when I was putting together my recommendations, I thought, I have to put this on the list. So it was published in 1991, and I have a copy that my partner's father gave to his mother for Christmas in 1994. And then my partner read it years ago. His mom gave it to him. And for some reason, he said to me, Hayley, you've got to read this. I think you'll really like it. And it's a book that, yes, it charts a family history over 100 years. These three women, the first one, the grandmother was married off to a powerful warlord as a concubine in the early 1900s in China. Her mother was then an important figure in the Communist Party. And that's the part that I'm in now. Mm-hmm. And then the writer's story has yet to emerge for me. But it's beautifully written and genuinely enlightening. I'm learning so much about China's history in recent years, and it's a propulsive read. It's just action-packed, and it's like candy. I can't stop.
Many are sort of fascinated by that particular period of time, because obviously not a whole lot was known in the West, really, about Mao's impact on China, the way women were treated, of course, and their experience. So, an utterly fascinating read, and very much a classic, I think, for us. Wild Swans by Yung Tang. Phil, let's go to your next pick, shall we? Which is a pop culture pick, The Divine David Presents. Was it on Channel 4? Back in the day, yes, it was on Channel 4. It was a series back in the late 90s. A showcase for performance art hosted by David Hoyle in character as the Divine David. Here's a bit from the theme song. I might just cut that short before anyone thinks we've gone mad here at Times Radio, or press the fast forward button on a tape. Tell us why you like this. So you've been revisiting this, what, through the More4 app or just online?
Yes. And actually, it's not possible to find all of it. You find fragments online. I don't know why, because actually was produced by a company called World of Wonder, who were then famous for producing RuPaul's Drag Race. So we're talking about a huge production company and that's one of their earliest and actually extremely obscure and bizarre works. Perhaps that's why you can't find it so easily. For me and for our group and for queer contemporary art, I think this is an extremely important piece. And moment in TV history, because as we progress in contemporary queer cultures, there we see a sort of normalization of the way in which queer narratives are told. We're in the 21st century. We're going through a sort of homonormative, if you will, moment where. Movies are kind of instead of boy meets girl, they become boy meets boy. But other than that, they're 100% formally traditional. And so it is interesting to go back to a time where it still was quite transgressive to do queer art. Mm-hmm. And for us, this is actually an interesting. I think for queer history, this is an interesting meeting point now, and this is something that we also discuss in our work, in our film. Now that we've reached this point where there are a lot of queer people in politics and so on, is this what we wanted? Is this what we really wanted? And so, our work sort of responds no. It's kind of a rhetorical question, but. Yeah. But yeah, I think someone like David Hoyle is really from this era that that he really understood that the connection between avant-garde entertainment and queer politics. Yeah. And he really believed that this is something that should go together. And for me, coming from Greece, that TV is actually quite traditional, to see something like this on TV, that the show is really mad. I mean,
yeah.
It features I'm not even sure if you could make even in the UK something like that still today.
Yeah, maybe not.
It features performers that do body mutilation and things like that.
It definitely would not get past TV executives these days, it has to be said. I'm going to cut you off there, Phil, because we must go to your last picks before we run out of time. Hayley, you've gone for a comedy. It's a show that was at the Soho Theatre. It's Cats, written and performed by Frankie Thompson, directed by Liv Ello. It went to the Edinburgh Fringe, actually, after Soho, didn't it, as well?
Yes.
Give me 30 seconds on the big sell for this. Why do you love it so much?
Oh my gosh. Okay, it's coming back to the Soho Theatre in November for a week. I saw it in Edinburgh and I loved it. I think that Frankie and Liv are on the forefront of where comedy is going. It's an almost indefinable style of absurdist performance. It explores how we might keep the noise in our brains quiet by watching cat videos and wishing that we too were a cat. But the show is almost entirely lip-synced. And yes, there's some bits from Cats, but it's not just Cats. There's also totally wild other clips. And it's just unexpected at every turn. And Frankie is a magnetic and captivating and very, 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 I should say, captivating, funny performer. So I really encourage people to go. It's extraordinarily wild comedy.
At the Soho Theatre, coming up later this year, Cats, written and performed by Frankie Thompson. Phil, your final pick is by Sophie, and it is Sophie's album Oil of Every Pearl's Uninsides. It's from 2018. Sophie was a Scottish music producer, singer and DJ. She was best known for her experimental takes on pop music and helped pioneer the genre of hyperpop. Sadly, she had a fall and an accidental fall in Athens, Greece, and unfortunately she passed away after that in January last year. So she had a really sort of tragic end to her life. Let's listen to a track from the album Whole New World / Pretend World, from the album Oil of Every Pearl's Uninsides. So, Phil, give me 20 seconds, if you can, because we're really short on time, about why this is such an important album for you.
Can I just really quickly say that I agree with Hayley's recommendation and Cats is amazing. Okay. For me, Sophie was like the ultimate millennial artist. She knew that being an emotional wreck, at the same time being funny about it, is the only way to deal with yourself in our postmodern times. So for me, this is like, and we were really devastated that she passed away, because this was like post-human music for the next centuries.
There you go. Well, fortunately, through music, her legacy lives on, doesn't it? That is Sophie. Do check out her music. That was from the album Oil of Every Pearl's Uninsides. Thank you to both of you for joining us on Times Radio this evening. It's been wonderful to hear your opinions and your views. Phil Iropoulos, who's an artist and filmmaker, his queer opera Orpheus 2021 will be at the Whitechapel Gallery this September. And Hayley McGee, whose show Age is a Feeling will be on at the Soho Theatre from September. Thank you to both of you. Great to speak to you.